Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today, my first open forum, and I'm not even sure that's what I want to call it, but that's what we'll call it right now, an open forum. Looking forward to your phone calls and your emails. Phone 614-292-8513 and email us at allsides@wosu.org. Today, talk about a whole bunch of stuff. The president's getting set to sign a bill that would widen the hate crimes laws in the United States. Issue two, do we need a constitutional amendment to for oversight of animal agricultural animal care in the state of Ohio? Pay cuts for Wall Street executives, school levies. Is it any coincidence that the districts where they're struggling to get levies passed also are among those that have kindergartners entering school with the fewest skills? The H1N1 vaccine, good, bad, running out. What do you think? Public disclosure of paid endorsements by doctors for pharmaceutical companies. Suzanne Hoholic of the Columbus Dispatch wrote about that this week. I thought that was very interesting. Do you want to know what your doctor has been paid to push a particular drug? And finally, City Center. The county has offered $3 million to preserve a six-acre park at the City Center site. What do you think about that? We'll start off, though, with the president is set to sign a bill widening hate crime laws. What this would do, he's signing a bill. It's part of a defense authorization measure, but this segment of it would update the federal hate crime statute that Congress passed in 1968. And for the first time, the law that had previously protected people from attacks motivated by race, religion, or ethnicity will now include gay, lesbian, transgender, and disabled people. This new law, some might see it as symbolic, but it really does let the Justice Department kind of get involved in ways merely beyond just charging people with crimes, because most of those crimes are charged at the local level. Now the federal government can help state and local officials tackle hate crimes by providing them with federal investigators, forensic tools, and money. That's according to National Public Radio Report. On tap with me to talk about this, Michael Daniels. He is co-publisher of Outlook Media. And Michael, what do you think?
Well, good morning, Ann. Thanks
good
for
morning.
Having me on.
Thank you.
I think that you described this exactly correctly. This really is an updating of the hate crimes legislation, which currently protects or affects crimes based on religion, race, color, or national origin. This updates to include sexual orientation, gender identity, which you mentioned, but it also updates to include gender, disability, and military status. So this really is bringing the hate crimes legislation into alignment with the protected classes that we think of. And you're exactly right. It doesn't actually change what's a crime. What it does is it allows for federal resources. Money is nice, but often it's personnel and access to forensic facilities and that sort of thing. It allows those resources to now be brought to bear on crimes that were committed based on a prejudice against someone's disability, gender, military status, sexual orientation, or gender identity. So something that the GLBT community has been looking for a long time. I believe that the vote in the U.S. Senate to accept the conference report was the 14th vote in the U.S. Congress on this. We've been working on this bill for over a decade.
Since Matthew Shepard was murdered.
Exactly. And it's named after Matthew Shepard. In fact, the young man who was brutally murdered in Wyoming,
right.
Which is no question, despite what Representative Fox from North Carolina might have you believe, was no doubt motivated simply by the fact that he was gay. And ever since then, we've been looking to do this. And in fact, Matthew Shepard's parents will be at the signing ceremony behind the president today.
It's a particularly bright note for the transgender community, right? I mean, they don't pretty much get much of anything.
Yeah, the transgendered community gets left out of a lot. And I think it's really important to understand that this hate crimes legislation is fully inclusive of not only sexual orientation, but also gender identity. And a lot of times people get confused about what that means. It's not just folks who are transitioning from one gender to another, but there are cases that happen all the time. We just saw a case, not I think just this week, of of a school, and I don't even remember where. It was down south someplace, who refused to allow a young lady's senior photograph to appear in the yearbook because she chose to pose for her senior pictures wearing a tuxedo rather than wearing a dress. And they found that an inappropriate gender expression. You know, people get beat up all the time because they look too effeminate or look too masculine or don't fit someone else's definition of good, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And this legislation simply says, you know what, just as if you commit a crime against a person because they're black or because they are from a particular country, and we can bring those federal resources to bear. Remember, this legislation was first enacted after the assassination of Dr. King.
Right. You know, I've got some statistics here that we'll go over in a second. They're amassed by the FBI. It was released in the publication Hate Crime Statistics from 2006. That's the best I could do. But another thing that the legislation would do is change or expand the FBI's ability to track hate crimes. So in Ohio, for example, the number of Ohio law enforcement agencies who submitted the hate crime supplement into that report and say that the incidents increased from 443 in 2005 to 493 in 2006, which is an 11% increase. But they're saying the folks who know say it probably is much higher because if it's not against the law per se, it's harder to track.
That's correct. And that is one of the issues that because Ohio does not have a state hate crimes law, it's pretty much left up to local municipalities as to whether they track whether something is a biased crime or not. And the FBI has always recorded these numbers if someone bothered to call. But for instance, you referred to Matthew Shepard's death, which mm-hmm. was sort of the seminal incident in starting this this piece of legislation. Matthew Shepard's death was not tracked by the FBI as a hate crime because the state of Wyoming did not have hate crimes legislation.
Exactly. And another issue is the money. It would allow the Justice Department to help local law enforcement agencies prosecute or investigate and then prosecute because the community where Matthew Shepard was murdered almost went bankrupt managing the case.
Right. Absolutely. As we know, law enforcement departments are spread thin to begin with. And then when there are cutbacks, a lot of times the biased crimes officers and those sorts of folks, we're not suggesting that the police don't investigate murder, that they say, oh, well, that was the murder of a gay person, so we don't care. We're not suggesting that that's what happened. But this does allow for not only money, but resources, actually putting federal investigators on the case. Actually being able to bring federal crime lab the resources to the table to investigate and prosecute these cases. And again, we're really pleased in the GLBT community that this includes sexual orientation and gender identity. But for the first time, it's never been a hate crime to attack someone because they were handicapped, to attack someone because they were female, or to attack someone because they were an active or active duty military or veteran. And this legislation expands to all those areas. So we just think this is a good thing in general. And it's interesting that part of the reason I think this hadn't passed before was that for 8 years, President Bush said he would veto the bill. He would veto the Pentagon spending bill if it contained this legislation. And in fact, most of the opposition votes in the Senate were not opposing the Pentagon budget, but right. They were opposing this particular piece of protective legislation.
Yeah, I was hoping to get the breakdown of who voted for it and who voted against it from Ohio, but I haven't been able to get that yet.
Both Senators Brown and Voinovich supported the bill.
Okay. And do we know about Congress? Anything about that? I mean, the House.
Could find the House numbers. Mm-hmm. It fell not exactly across party lines. I know that Representative Boehner voted against it, but I think that was a Republican leadership issue.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that this was tacked in as an amendment to the defense authorization bill.
Yeah, who votes against defense? Is that the philosophy there?
I think that was part of the philosophy. I know that this was, I think that Senator Kennedy saw this as a great way to bring this legislation up in the last Congress. The House had passed this piece of legislation as a standalone piece of legislation in the last Congress.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't stand a chance in the Senate as a standalone piece of legislation. And so Senator Kennedy put it in as an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill, and it passed. But then, of course, when it got to conference, it was taken back out. And I think we saw that it was, you know, this makes a lot of sense to just put this in as an amendment to a bigger bill. And it does make it harder to vote against it. Several Republicans did vote against it based on the fact that it included the hate crimes legislation. The only Democrat in the Senate to vote against it was Senator Feingold, mm-hmm. who supported the hate crimes legislation but voted against the bill because of he disagreed with the funding for the ongoing funding for the war in the Pentagon bill. So,
yeah, it probably made it harder to vote for it, but it also made it harder to vote against it, and it
right.
gave people who maybe, you know, lawmakers who maybe wanted to vote for it but can't say, hey, I had to vote for the defense budget bill.
Exactly.
You know, it makes it easier. I was surprised. The statistics, of course, they're from 2006 and a lot of changes in 3 years. But and again, they're not necessarily great statistics. But nationwide, the majority of hate crime incidents, 52%, involved racial bias. The remaining incidents involved religion, 19%, sexual orientation, 15%, ethnicity, national origin, 13%, and disability, 1%. Who the heck? I mean, the disability thing. What? Is there a hate group against disability?
I think that what you see in terms of a lot of that, and I think we'll see those numbers shift to some extent, Anne, because when the groups of sexual orientation and gender expression and disability were really not included under the previous hate crimes legislation, it was sort of a catch-as-catch-can as to whether those numbers got reported. My gut feeling is that the majority of the hate crimes perpetrated against people with disabilities were perpetrated against people with mental disabilities.
Okay.
That old stigma of that person's crazy, and targeting people based on behaviors that may have to do with some sort of a disability. And I suppose that you know, there could be someone sick enough to say that person walks with a limp, or let's go beat up the blind guy.
Now that you mention it, I mean, we do hear about those kind of,
yeah,
but that's just depravity.
Yeah, absolutely. But quite honestly, attacking someone simply because of who they are, mm-hmm. whether that's color or orientation or religion or disability, or whether or not they happen to be a veteran of the U.S. military, it's depravity at all levels.
Mm-hmm. What does this say about the contradiction in the U.S. military now? Don't ask, don't tell. That's still the law of the land.
It is.
Any hopes?
You're seeing the tide sort of turn on that. At his recent address to the Human Rights Campaign National Dinner and Gathering in conjunction with the Equality March in Washington a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
President Obama renewed his commitment to repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We've seen many people who were in favor of it when it was first passed under the Clinton administration now say, you know what, this is antiquated, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Most active duty military personnel say it doesn't matter to them. We know that openly gay and lesbian service members are serving in the armed forces of Britain and Australia and France and a variety of other countries with no detriment either to performance or morale. And I think what you're beginning to see is a disproportionate number of particular professions, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Being discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. A ridiculously large number of linguists, particularly Arabic linguists and technology folks, being discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And this may be one of the only good repercussions, in my opinion, of the war. Is that in wartime, all service members become more important to the government, and it's starting to look at the, wow, we've been affecting this huge brain drain by discharging people simply based on their sexual orientation. It's important also, and I think, to point out that don't ask, don't tell doesn't protect a gay or a lesbian person who acts inappropriately. The Uniform Code of Military Justice already says that sexual harassment won't be tolerated and that rape won't be tolerated and all those other sorts of, you know, promiscuity and those sorts of things won't be tolerated. And they wouldn't be from gay folks as well as they shouldn't be from straight members of the military. But don't ask, don't tell is certainly a piece of legislation that was, it was wrong then, it's even more wrong now, and I think that it and an employment non-discrimination bill will be the next two pieces of legislation directly impacting the GLBT community. And I think that we'll see both movement on both of those fairly quickly.
Okay, Michael Daniels, co-publisher of Outlook Media. I know you have to take off. I appreciate you taking time.
And thanks so much for having me.
Okay, take care.
All right, take care.
Okay, we got to take a short break. I'm a little bit over on that. I guess I get undisciplined during open forum. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News, 54 degrees in downtown Columbus. Join us later this afternoon at 4 o'clock for All Things Considered. California's three strikes law keeps criminals in prison, sometimes for life. And it keeps the lives of several people in the state preoccupied with either preserving the policy or changing it to be less strict. Examining 15 years of three strikes, beginning on All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock right here on WOSU. In the weather forecast, gray skies today, a high of 58 degrees. Skies clear tonight, a low of 45. Sunshine for Thursday, and a high of 68 degrees. And Thursday night, a few clouds and a low of 52. And now back to All Sides.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is open forum today. We were just talking about the event to take place in a little while. The president is going to sign a bill widening hate crime laws to include gay, lesbian, transgender, and disabled people. I'd love to hear your comments on that. I was just talking with Michael Daniels, co-publisher of Outlook Media. He obviously, they're happy. The legislation would give the FBI the authority to help local law enforcement fund investigations, fund prosecutions, that sort of thing. That's one of the biggest problems with hate crimes is that they're very, very expensive to charge in and to investigate and to prosecute. So if you have a comment about that, I'd love to hear it. Meanwhile, we do have Doug on the line right now, and you want to talk about something I didn't even bring up. So shoot, Doug.
Well, to your last discussion quickly.
Sure.
I think they should have called the hate crimes domestic terrorism because they're crimes committed on one person in order to scare a whole group of people. And that's the definition of terrorism.
That's interesting.
But what I called in on is about the Fox News, Obama White House, getting a lot of attention. We kind of forget how the Bush White House sent letters to MSNBC president, kind of saying, hey, watch your coverage and stuff like that.
I don't remember that. Refresh my memory.
Well, Ed Gillespie of the Bush White House sent a letter to the president saying, you know, you're getting opinion and news mixed in together, which is pretty rich because Fox News, I mean, they call themselves news, but it's not news. It's all one-sided opinion
but
shows.
But tactically, do you think the president was smart to start this? We could argue who's starting what, but, you know, was it tactically very wise?
I think it's brilliant because it highlights how Fox News isn't news, that they're almost all opinion shows, one-sided opinion shows. I mean, MSNBC says they're the place for politics. They don't go out and say we're a news organization. You know, it kind of waters down the word news when you have, you know, what Fox Opinion is out there. And MSNBC has, you know, Pat Buchanan on all the time, and they have Joe Scarborough in the morning, who's a conservative. And in all storytelling, you know, every hero is as great as its nemesis. You know, what would Batman be without the Joker, or Superman without Lex Luthor? And I think Fox News is the perfect target for president, you know, for the Obama White House.
I guess it's sort of plain speaking that, I mean, the president just kind of laid it out there. He doesn't, and they're not doing much to respond to the criticism either of doing that.
Who isn't doing
much? The president.
Well, he's kind of backed off a little bit now. But,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the conservatives have been so successful in saying the media is liberal and reporters and, you know, the media, they bend over backwards, most of the media, you know, to try to be fair. And I think it can work the other way. I think that's I think that'll pay dividends. Maybe that'll get a few more liberals on Fox News. And so what if more people watch Fox? You know, only 20% of people are identifying themselves as Republicans, and I think Rush Limbaugh and Fox News are partially responsible because most people are turned off by it.
Okay. Well, Doug, thanks for your call.
And one other thing.
Yeah, sure.
What would be the repercussions if a Dispatch reporter was at a progressive rally and, you know, cheering on the crowd and rallying the crowd? You had a Fox News producer at the 9/12 rally, you know, actually rallying the crowd for the cameras. I mean, you'd be in big trouble if you did that, wouldn't you?
I do not do that. That's true. I like to laugh, but I don't like to rally others. I just expect them to follow. But, yeah, okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Okay,
we have an email. It's our first email from Daniel. He says, Ann, I would like to be your first email. Question for your open phones. Oh, open phones. How come that most of your guests are women? you know, I don't know. Daniel, I didn't know that. It's certainly nothing contrived. It would give me too much credit for planning and forethought on that score. But we'll crunch those numbers and get back with you on that. There's no, I suppose I don't even think about it. It may be that I'm talking to a lot of administrative type people who run agencies and so forth. And maybe they tend to be women. I really don't know. Email back and give me your impressions. Give me some examples of when that's been the most noticeable to you. The second question, can you have Fred Anderle back as a guest once in a while? I'm sure you miss his voice. I was lucky I saw him Saturday night. I understand that. And, of course, we'll have Fred back in as a guest. I love Fred. And if he'll deign to be my guest, but not right away. We don't have any plans right now, but we've certainly talked about it, and it's you know, an option that I will avail myself of as soon as it makes sense. Thanks, Daniel, for your email. You know, something I wanted to talk about was a story by Jennifer Smith Richards from the Columbus Dispatch. She wrote about, and I referenced it in the last hour, about how four-year-olds are learning to recognize about young children, pre-kindergartners, who are not being taught the basics, that they're coming to school not even ready to – they don't even know that you read from left to right in a book. They don't even know what the dotted lines across the page. They don't know that those are sentences. They don't know words. They don't know their alphabet. And what fascinated me about it probably more than anything was how the percentages of kids like that who come from school districts where they're really struggling to raise money. The lowest kindergarten scores, for example, come from Whitehall, Southwestern, Hamilton, Groveport, Madison, Columbus. Columbus doesn't happen to be on that list of districts asking for money, but be that as it may. And it makes me wonder, there's been a lot of criticisms of Southwestern City that it's not doing its job right. It's not, you know, that's one of the reasons why people don't want to give money, because it's always scoring low in the state assessments. Why should we give money? Why should we reward that? And when I look at numbers like this, it makes me wonder, you know, maybe this too many kids are not coming to school prepared, and it starts out a little bit earlier than the day they enter the classroom. If you'd like to join this conversation, I would welcome it. 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Anyways, let's see. Jennifer said that these kids coming to school unprepared like this is particularly difficult challenge for two reasons. Preparing small children for school isn't usually the responsibility of a K-12 school district, but it still must spend time and money to help kids catch up. So it makes me wonder, how much money does Southwestern City, for example, have to spend to help so many of these kids catch up? It's very expensive. It requires often requires specialists, special teachers, special training. I know that the reading recovery program, for example, for kids who are behind in reading when they start the first grade, it's very expensive, certainly very worthwhile, but very expensive. So what's a school like Southwest to do? I'd love to know. I'd love to hear what you think about that. It says that who's ready? There's a little sidebar to this. The bottom line, schools that parents choose appear to attract more prepared kindergarten students than schools to which children are assigned. That's interesting, Jennifer. The data, scores on the kindergarten readiness assessment, literacy, new kindergarten students in Ohio public schools take each fall. And the findings, in seven major Ohio urban districts, magnet schools, which have students from a wide geographic area within a school district, and charter schools attracted children who have more developed early literacy skills. District magnet schools, they're called alternative schools in Columbus, had an average score of 20 out of a possible 29, and charter schools had an average score of 18.27 on the fall 2008 test. Neighborhood schools in the urban districts had lower scores. The average for schools that draw from a set attendance area was 16.89. So I guess that's okay. I've been told. Go to Michelle. You're on the air. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I just want to say first, big fan of the show.
you're welcome.
Thank you for everything you do.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment as someone who came up through you know, the K-12 school district. I have dyslexia, which wasn't diagnosed until the eighth grade. And I had trouble reading and things like that in the earlier grades. But a lot of what helped me was my parents. And I think that that's probably a huge issue, is that a lot of the kids out there right now aren't receiving the at-home, you know, reading stories at night or having parents help them with their homework, that sort of thing. So I think that may have a lot to do with the school districts that are struggling to get the fourth graders or the, you know, younger kids up to date.
Now, when you started school, Michelle, did you know you had dyslexia when you started? Did your parents know?
No.
Okay.
It was something that I struggled with, and it wasn't something that was even really looked into until the fifth grade when I had trouble reading. You know, I was having trouble passing spelling tests because I couldn't get the, you know, the letters in the correct order. I went into a special reading class, and then it wasn't really until the eighth grade when the math became a huge issue that I was really sat down and they evaluated me. And
that's a long time.
Yeah, it was.
That's a long time to struggle. You know, I had Byron Pitts on earlier this week. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's the chief national correspondent for CBS News, and he's a special correspondent for 60 Minutes. And he didn't know that he was functionally illiterate until he wasn't diagnosed with it until he was 12 years old.
Yeah.
And it's kind of amazing. So when you first started school, did you know to read from left to right?
Yes.
Okay.
My parents, you know, did read with me, and I like to read. I just found it very difficult. It was slightly frustrating, especially if it was things that I liked to read.
I'm sorry, Michelle. I hung up on you. I apologize. Call back. We'll get back with you on that. I want to talk. In the meantime, we've got Scott Listener on the phone. He is the coordinator for OSU for ADA. And he's going to get called in to talk about the disability segment of the hate crime bill. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not bad.
So happy, glad, ecstatic, who cares? What do you think?
Happy, glad. I'm not sure about ecstatic.
Okay.
But certainly not who cares. the hate crimes bill that is on Obama's desk today that he's signing includes disability as one of the categories. And it's particularly timely, I think, currently because of the amendments that just went into effect this past year and the new regulations that are being promoted by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission around disability access and disability rights. So it is a time where I think individuals with disabilities are going to be increasingly visible along with the 20th anniversary of the ADA. And so it's nice to be included in this revised protection from the hate crimes bill.
When I was talking to Michael Daniels from Outlook, he speculated that a lot of hate crimes against people who are disabled have to do with mental disabilities. Do you have any sense about who we're talking about here?
I think the data seems to suggest two groups in a lot of ways in a very broad sense, and individuals with mental disabilities, particularly in the K-12 system, get a lot of bullying, and I think that's one group that this is offering protections to potentially that's particularly important. There is also been traditionally some issues around individuals who require personal attendance to help with activities of daily living and some of those things, the issues around interacting with the broader community and their attendant, and the issues of attendance actually being abusive in a variety of ways, and some of them in a kind of serial way that would start to meet some of the hate crime requirements.
Okay. Now, one aspect of this bill, I know you got to go. You came out of a meeting, and I appreciate that, is the funding issue for hate crimes. We were talking about the Matthew Shepard case in Wyoming, and that almost broke the bank in that community to investigate and prosecute that case. Is that as much of an issue when it comes to disability rights?
I think the investigative process is in many ways not dissimilar. I think one of the things that hate crime bill does potentially is by authorizing some federal jurisdiction, you get some assistance with some of that investigation through the Department of Justice or the Office for Civil Rights out of the Department of Education, depending on the context of the crime. There already is some investigative agencies around disability that the federal government has in place regionally around the country that could be co-opted now under federal investigation versus state and local community investigation.
Okay. Scott Listner, ADA coordinator for OSU. We got to take a quick break. Thank you so much, Scott, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Take care. Okay. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. NPR News. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, send 44,000 more troops to Afghanistan? Maybe just 15,000 more Marines? We speak with Washington Post Pentagon correspondent Greg Jaffe about the military options facing President Obama. Jaffe is co-author of the new book, The Fourth Star, about the four generals who led the U.S. military's efforts in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. 54 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. It's your choice. Just go to WOSU.org/email to sign up for one of our WOSU e-newsletters. And in the weather forecast for today, gray skies for the most of the day. Maybe a little bit of sunshine will peek out this afternoon. A high of 58. Skies clear overnight, a low of 45. Sunshine for Thursday and a high of 68 degrees. Thursday night, a few clouds and a low of 52. Looking ahead to Friday, rain showers and a high of 67 degrees for Friday. Currently 54 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, my first open forum, and my apologies once again to my first casualty, Michelle. We were talking. I disconnected the phone in my excitement. So apologies, Michelle. Please call back if you'd like to talk more about that. That was interesting. And right now, let's go to Rod. Rod, you're on the air. So thanks for waiting.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to bring up, you had cutbacks to libraries in the past hour, and I wanted to bring up the fact that services to various groups have been cut back as well. To give you an example, I receive services from a from an agency called Center for Vocational Alternatives, and they receive their funding. They're a private agency, but they receive their funding from the Adam Board,
the county board,
and which receives their money, some of their money from the state, and they've had to cut back their hours, and their resource center where people can go and look for jobs on computer and so forth because their funding's been cut.
So you're saying that gets cut at the libraries, it's getting cut there, it's getting cut everywhere. There aren't a lot of alternatives for folks.
That's true. And it's, to me it's interesting that right now they're cutting help back to some of the people that need it most, people that are out there looking for work, trying to do something, trying to look for work and trying to help themselves, but don't have the material resources. That one gentleman called in and mentioned about, the email that mentioned about
using the internet.
Internet. You can't use the internet if you don't have a computer terminal.
Right. If you don't have internet access and that sort of thing. We were talking about the funding mechanism, and for many, many years, since the mid 1980s, Ohio has funded it at the state level with supplements at the local level if necessary. That's changing. What do you think about that?
Well,
where do you live?
Okay, I live in North Columbus.
Okay.
And basically, I feel that the funding should basically come from the state. That's one thing. Some of the wealthier communities might be able to fund some of these programs themselves, but some of the less wealthy communities might not be able to fund some of these programs.
Okay. All right. Well, Rod, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We have another email from Chris. Chris says, I want to respond to an earlier email about your numerous female guests. We have not established this fact, folks. It's just speculation at this point. As a longtime listener to Freddie Enderle's show, the email goes on to say, my observation would be that most of his guests were male. So while you are crunching your numbers, crunch his too. But I don't think there is anything nefarious going on in either case. It's probably just that each of you is more in tune with issues related to your gender, and we need more women's voices on the air anyway. Thanks, Chris. Personally, on a personal note. Thank you, Chris. Okay. Sarah, you're on the air. You want to talk about public versus charter schools? Sarah?
Sarah, hi.
Hi,
Ann. Thank you. I really wanted interested, and I was got disturbed for a moment, but you were really laying out the numbers of the test scores between what the difference between the charter schools is versus lottery schools. And, I find those numbers really interesting because as a parent of a child, when we were looking at where to send our daughter to school, I think there's so much that, you got to look at in terms of education. And I didn't know these test scores, but we opted to send our daughter to a lottery school when we got chosen.
Is this in Columbus City?
It is in Columbus.
Okay.
My daughter goes to Indianola Informal, which has recently gone from a elementary school to a K-8.
Okay.
And so, those numbers, and I guess I don't totally understand here in the state of Ohio what those numbers are based on. And I don't know, I would like to hear a little bit more about, your thoughts on or what people are saying the difference between the charter school and the lottery school or public education, and how come those numbers are so varied? I mean, I have my own personal opinions about it, but
some of the research has shown that people who take the effort to choose a school for their child instead of just sending their school to wherever the district's going to send them anyway. In other words, they avail themselves of the charter option, or they send their kids to private school, or they send them, you know, go through the effort to send them to a lottery school, tend to be more involved parents. It's a marker for that kind of a thing. So the scores will tend to be higher. Not always, but they'll tend to be higher because of that level of parent involvement, which everybody says is key. And really, that's what we're getting at with Jennifer Smith Richards' story in the Dispatch that was on Sunday, that, you know, these kids are coming to school not prepared at all. And there's nothing the districts can do about it. So somebody who never reads to their kid ever, to the extent that the kid doesn't even know to read from left to right, do you think they're really going to make an effort to get him into a lottery school?
No, that's right. And the process is somewhat difficult. Like, it took me a long time to get my head around what the process was and what you had to go through. But I'm very glad I did it. And again, you know, just going to the parent involvement, I've just been so impressed with Indianola, the way they are able to take and break down and make it so easy to volunteer. Like, I work full-time, but I'm going to be going in every Friday, 8:30 to 9:15, to do a very simple task for the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's both ways. When parents are willing to step up and you have the time and the ability, which I think is such a hard part of public education, because the folks who probably aren't involved are the people who are working 2 and 3 jobs.
Yes.
And
maybe weren't read to themselves as children. I mean, a lot of it's cultural.
Right.
It's something that's passed on through generations. And, I was at a PTSA meeting last week, and they had some guy in there talking about drugs and junior high kids and all that kind of stuff. And he said he was talking about all the different markers of families that are likely to have problems with it and families that are not. And he said one of the markers for him is that you're just the fact that you're here means that it's less likely. If you have dinner together 3 times a week, it's less likely that your kid will get involved in drugs at the junior high level. There are all these markers, and I'm sure the same is true for education readiness.
Right.
So, well, thanks, Sarah.
Well, thank you, Ann.
Take care. There's another female voice, darn it. Hey, Henry, you're a male. Henry, you're on the air.
I think I'm a male.
Yeah, I so.
Anyway, you had a program earlier about the libraries.
Right.
And all I can think of is, well, I use the libraries, and I vote for the levies all the time. But I am reminded about the old joke where a guy asks a gambler, why do you gamble in such and such place? And the guy says, well, it's the only game in town. And basically, that is why I use the library. I go to the libraries, and I feel they have deteriorated in quality.
Well, how so?
Okay.
Be specific.
If you go to the main library, you're going to see shelves that are partly empty. The library claims that it is the best one in the country. If you go there, you will see many DVDs, which are cartoons. I have nothing against cartoons, but I think there are too many of them. If you go to the shelves, you are going to see too many books, which are soft-covered, and they are thin. They are...
Okay, well, that might be the author's fault.
No, it is not the author's fault.
Okay.
It is the fault of the people who choose the book.
You know, one thing about Columbus Metropolitan Library System, though, is it doesn't say it's the best in the country.
It is because
it is rated that by outside organizations, not by itself. It is only availing itself of honors that have been bestowed on it by others outside. So just to clear the record on that, I mean, they're obviously proud of that, and they make a point of telling people a lot. But, who could blame them, Henry?
They certainly boast of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but wouldn't you?
But okay, now.
Okay. Back to specifics.
Okay, I'm being specific.
Okay.
If a library has a book and the book is not used for 5 years or 10 years, and there is empty space on the shelf, there is no reason to get rid of that book. That book should be kept. Unless there is a book that will replace it, then it can be disposed of. But if you see empty shelves in libraries, then that book should be kept.
Okay.
Doesn't matter if it hasn't been taken out for a long time. There are too many DVDs. I borrow a lot of DVDs because I hardly ever watch commercial TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I am dependent upon a library. But I think there are too many cartoons.
But nobody's making you take them.
That's right, and I certainly don't.
Okay.
And if you go to the libraries, you will find fewer mainstream movies, even at the main library, than there used to be. Now, I know the library says they have floating collections, and the libraries do go out. But I have been in other systems, the Worthington, which has books that the Columbus Library does not have because they've gotten rid of them.
Okay. Well, fair criticism. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Take care, Henry.
Okay.
If you would like to join the conversation on whatever topic, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org, and the more guys, the better. Abe, you're on the air.
Hi,
I
have two things to comment on.
Okay.
First of all, the charter school. One of the things that's interesting, I did an analysis, and for our district, for the Worthington district, there are a large number of parents, and the number, I'm in the car and I can't look at the number, but there are a large number of parents who send their children to charter schools.
In Worthington? Or,
yes, there are 100 and some, almost 100. And a large number of them go to schools that have lower test scores at the lowest school in Worthington. So one wonders about that. And, you know, that is, and that money, and that costs money to the school district. And that's a different issue.
Well, and the state is starting to crack down on that. They want they want to, you know, make the standards a little tougher, that these charter schools can't go on, you know, ad infinitum, you know, with these low test scores. They've got to show improvement, just like the districts do now.
Yeah, but still, you know, still there's that. And many of the schools are the electronic schools. Many of the kids go to
the
online schools. Mm-hmm. And so I have been wondering about the book of the library. I don't know if your caller realizes that the state has cut down the money on libraries an awful lot.
Well, that's what we were talking about, and he was responding to that last. We were talking about that last hour, Abe, and that's what he was calling about. But yeah, that's been going on for a long time too.
But the other thing is that since he mentioned the Worthington Library and the Columbus Library, they're in the same system in a way. So if Worthington doesn't have a book that Columbus does, he can ask for it, and get it, because I know that we have gotten books out from the Columbus, not only books but books online and DVDs and all this from the Columbus Library that the Worthington Library doesn't have.
See, it cuts both ways.
It goes both ways. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is just ask for it, and eventually it'll show up.
Okay.
You know, that's it.
Well, Abe, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye.
Oh, Denise, I just disconnected you. I apologize. Please call back. I want to talk to you. Sharon, you're on the air. Brady's on the phone with Sharon. Okay. Well, anyways, Denise wanted to talk about kids' readiness. I hope she will call right back, and I apologize. I guess I just got to get the knack of this. Sharon's back now. Can I pull her up? Okay. Sharon, you're on the air.
Yeah,
sorry about that.
It's okay. I want to say, when people speak about education,
okay,
education starts from small, from the home. Meaning that you teach your kids the alphabet, like you were saying, number, shape, size, and so forth. But parents do have to work correctly. But when they take their children to, they call them not child care provider, but they call them somebody who looks after their child.
Babysitter?
Yes, they call them a babysitter. And I'm saying, I have two masters. I left the professional world. I have an MBA and a master's in engineering. I give that up to deal with children. I teach them, but it's how you teach them. You have fun while you do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, But then you look at it, the parents don't want to pay for childcare, but yet still they won't pay $150 for sneakers and buy all the name brand. So it starts from very small.
Yeah, there's a lot of different pressures in society today.
Yeah.
Some of it's educational, some of it's social, trying to help your kid fit in. Parents have a lot of different pressures to deal with.
You know what? I agree with that. But then at the same time, they make you could put the alphabet on the wall on a piece of paper, and you just do it as passing, or the children want to learn. Point blank.
There's a project in Harlem. I think it's called the Harlem Project, and I was talking about it with a Harvard professor last week. And one of the elements of this very successful project is teaching parents how to teach their children.
Yes.
Often the parents themselves were not raised to read. They didn't have anybody reading to them when they were children. Why would it occur to them to do it for their own children? Even, you know, it seems so obvious to those of us who are raised with it, but it's not always. So that's something that's learned. It's not something you're born with. So
you're correct, because my mom read to us, and I saw my mom and dad reading. So I read, and I understand the value of education. Reading, writing, and arithmetic, those are the foundation. So when kids come to me, because I tutor kids also, mm-hmm. and they're failing in kindergarten, it breaks my heart.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. Sharon, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we've just got about a minute left. Becky, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I wanted to just... And how invaluable the public library has been to my family. I have a special needs child, and when he was diagnosed with a language disorder at the age of 2, it was going to be about 6 months before we could get him any services when it came to speech therapy. And one of the speech therapists who evaluated him suggested we look at some resources at the public library with DVDs that taught sign language to kids. And within a week, he was able to sign 50 words. And over the next year, he ended up having a vocabulary of about 300 words that really made a world of difference between him being able to communicate or not until he was able to find his voice through speech therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And also, something that I think a lot of parents might not be aware of is that the local libraries partner with volunteer organizations like Therapy Dogs. And over the summer, my kids got to go to the library and read to the dogs. And were just absolutely fascinated. And they're, you know, my oldest son's a reluctant reader, but he was like, let's get another book. Let's get another book.
That's great. I've heard of that before.
And that, it was just amazing just to see just with those two things. And even we're in Upper Arlington and have great library system, but the Upper Arlington School District has teachers who are recommending that we go to the Worthington Public Library website, because they have all sorts of wonderful programs online for kids, especially pre-readers, to get them ready for reading. And I'm just really thankful. So I'll go off the air now.
Well, Becky, thanks a lot for your call. That was our final call for the day. That is our final half minute of All Sides with Ann Fisher and my first open forum. Thanks to everybody who called and emailed. Sorry, I didn't get to all my emails. I apologize for that. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.